Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Issues in 30 days, issue 25, How Post-Racial 4 Years Later. Here is candidate Barack Obama in 2008.
Working together, we can move beyond some of our old racial wounds, and that in fact we have no choice. We have no choice if we are to continue on the path of a more perfect union.
Obama, from his famous speech on race during the 2008 campaign, black and white people alike felt that their different perceptions were being taken seriously by this mixed-race candidate. So where are we today? With me for this is Tricia Rose. She is professor of Africana Studies at Brown University and author of the book The Hip-Hop Wars. Hey, Tricia, welcome back to WNYC.
Oh, thanks for having me, Brian. It's great to be with you.
By the standards set out in that clip, have the last 4 years changed anything in your opinion? It seems to me racial issues may have been even more swept under the rug.
Yes, it has changed things in precisely the way you just noticed. They are not only more swept under the rug, but it appears that the sort of constellation of the way race has played out has made it impossible to really address current racism and structural inequality that results not just from old racial wounds, as he quoted, but really from contemporary and recent policies, approaches, and attitudes. So it's an amazing contradiction, right, that the first black president is the least able to speak about race in any meaningful way. But then on the other hand, doesn't it make perfect sense, right,
well,
that would happen?
In a way it does. But has Obama himself, in your opinion, failed to lead? I'm thinking over the last 4 years, when this has actually come up. And other than the beer summit in 2009 after Henry Louis Gates got arrested trying to enter his own home, and a bit around the Trayvon Martin shooting this year, the president has not really brought up racial disparities in those terms or brought up the perceptions of each side and tried to have people understand each other. The kind of thing we try to do on this show is a talk radio function. But things like that during his time in the White House that I think a lot of people expected of him after that race speech.
Yes. You know, Brian, you're absolutely right. And I guess, you know, I'm primarily disappointed about the very thing that you just said. There's not only been no discussing it, but there's been no acknowledgement of the profound level at which race is still a determinative factor for every major indice for quality of life, for opportunity, for health, for education, wealth, discrimination, all of the things that determine the quality of life. Race is the single biggest indicator for where you're going to fall. So how that can become a back burner non-issue is something we should be concerned with. Now, where I'm of two minds is that, you know, on the one hand, I think Obama has had a serious obligation, I hope if he wins he'll take it up more seriously, to really address this and to do it in a way that someone who is patient, someone who does understand outrage, fear, and concern and anxiety about losing privileges, which frankly many whites are afraid of, or feeling that the system will somehow shift too dramatically. But if he can take that up, that would be very powerful and important. On the other hand, I will say that the little bitty moments, Brian, that he raised any of these issues, he was, you know, met with such an onslaught of outrage, right-wing, you know, vitriol, mainstream silence, right? This is the culpability.
What's an opinion of that, an example of that, in your opinion?
Well, I mean, when he mentioned that he looked like Trayvon Martin, when his minister, articulated a completely, in many ways, reasonable set of frustrations based on American history, when he is asked about whether or not he can address African-American issues, he says he is the president of all America, not of black America. Right. So the combination there of the attacks against him, calling him the welfare president, calling him the food stamp president, calling him the president of people who are lazy and dispossessed, you know, and don't care and don't want to participate and just want to take from the government. All of these are racially coded contexts in which the idea of being black is maligned, that black people are blamed entirely for extraordinarily obvious and sustained structural conditions, and Obama doesn't defend that reality. He doesn't acknowledge it. And I just want to say one more thing, Brian, about this, because this is not just about talking to black people. This is about cultivating anti-racist white people. In other words, our identities are not fixed. We learn them through how our leaders model what ways we can work together and what kinds of people we should be. So to try to transcend race as if not talking about it is going to change the structural situation is complete denial and actually reinforces the conditions. So it's about cultivating anti-racist people of all races that I think is so important.
Here is a famous clip of President Obama early in his term in 2009 on not thinking about being the first black president.
Obviously, at the inauguration, I think that there was justifiable pride on the part of the country that we had taken a step to move us beyond some of the searing legacies of racial discrimination in this country. But that lasted about a day. And right now, the American people are judging me exactly the way I should be judged, and that is, are we taking the steps to improve liquidity in the financial markets, create jobs, get businesses to reopen, keep America safe? And that's what I've been spending my time thinking about.
President Obama from 2009, Tricia Rose from Brown University, my guest on WNYC as we talk about this in the context of our 30 Issues series. And perhaps, Tricia, in a slightly more upbeat take on it, just the optics of here is a black man for the first time in the White House talking about the things that he listed in this clip as his central missions to improve liquidity in the financial markets. That's not what white America thinks about with respect to black people. Create jobs, get businesses to reopen, keep America safe. Maybe there's something that models for the future, even if it's just subtext, both for young black Americans and for young white Americans and those of all ages, in terms of, the place of a black man in the United States in the 21st century.
Listen, I think there's no question that this is in many ways a landmark moment, right? And that having someone of his competence, of his intelligence in that position, has some substantial upsides. I mean, clearly I don't think it's fundamentally a downside. But I think that the way we talk about it and what we've allowed him to not address has more long-term repercussions than we're willing to acknowledge. That is to say, why not liquidity and structural inequality? Why not getting the economy on target by saying, hey, not just the middle class falling into poverty, but the poor as a whole, and why these numbers around race and gender are so different, so that we can all be part of this project? I think we don't want to concede that we should be invested in both of those things, because it looks like the new model of being a race leader or being a leader of African-American descent is to be unable to talk about race.
Mm-hmm.
That, to me, is a very dangerous idea, dangerous.
And I want to mention one issue that I think is really important to include in our 30-issue series, and that is America's incredible incarceration rate. This is high on the list of under-discussed topics of so many people who I read and I respect. The U.S. has more than 3% of our population under some kind of correctional supervision, that's jail, probation, or parole, and we incarcerate about 7 out of every 10,000 people. And that doesn't sound like a lot, but that's more than 7 times the rate for other industrialized countries, the ones which we generally compare ourselves with in the Western world, which incarcerate about 1 out of every 10,000. Our drug laws have a lot to do with it. The racial disparity is also stark here. Blacks make up about 13% of the population, but nearly 40% of those incarcerated. And I don't think I've ever heard President Obama talk about it.
Not one single solitary word. And, this allows the conservative and, in some cases, mainstream liberal fiction that black people not only are criminals, but that all those in jail are there because of their criminal behavior. And there's a project of criminalizing black people, responding to their conditions and circumstances in criminal ways when other constituencies are not responded to that way for similar behaviors.
The
silence on it produces it.
Yes, and I noticed that some conservatives also raise this issue. People you wouldn't expect, like anti-tax activist Grover Norquist, who sees a lot of government spending on prisons that he would like to see eliminated for lowering taxes purposes, and David Keene, former chair of the NRA, among those expressing concern about the incarceration rate in the United States compared to other countries that, you know, really have no more criminal behavior.
Well, you know, we don't probably have time for it here, but I think those are potentially some slippery alliances or an attempt to make an alliance when really, you know, the idea then is to have more of a wild, wild west scenario, right, where people shoot each other out. That's the, you know, the NRA context. And then to say, well, reducing taxes is an agenda that usually means cutting social safety nets. So rather than rehab for drug addicts and creating jobs and opportunities, they would rather just have, I think, you know, people's to be left to their own devices and to not use our collective resources. But nonetheless, there is a robust conversation. But race is the third rail, right? It's the thing we can't address. And the irony of that in this so-called fantasy of a post-race era means that we need to have a new language about how racism happens today, Brian. What we're looking for is the wrong thing. So when Obama said in that first clip you played, old racial wounds, we have to work together to get past old racial wounds, that is not what we're dealing with today. We're not dealing with the old racial wounds. We're dealing with structural conditions that are perpetuated by policies. Attitudes follow, yes, but if we can't address the reality of these structural constraints, then we foster, in a sense, white impatience and anger, because the attitude is, what do you want? What's the problem? Right? Why are you complaining? You know? Well, these are the facts. Sure. And so maybe a blue ribbon panel, right? I'd like to make an early request and say, okay, Obama wins, fingers crossed. And one of the first things he does is say, we need a blue ribbon panel on incarceration and the unjust histories of the policies and how they've taken place, what they've done to the communities of color and poor communities across race. And we want to address that. And a blue ribbon panel on racial discrimination and its effects today. Hey, why not?
And now, in our last few minutes, comes the reelection campaign. And, of course, opponents will use racially coded language to the extent that they can get away with it. The debunked accusation that he's gutting the work requirement in welfare is one example. Also, to my ears, different politicians flirt more with that line than others. And one of the most egregious to my ear is Newt Gingrich, who was a big proponent of the idea that Obama had a Kenyan mindset on foreign policy. You know what the subtext of that is. He was eager to say Kenyan. And the way Gingrich was running in the primaries and talked about food stamps, you talked about this line earlier, the food stamps president, and I want to play an example of it.
And if I become the nominee, I'm going to take a very simple symbol. I'm going to have food stamps versus paychecks. President Obama is the most effective food stamp president in American history. No president has put more people on food stamps than Obama. Now, this is not an attack. It's a statement. It's not negative. It's a fact.
He's put more people on food stamps. Obama as a food stamps president. It's very carefully parsed the way he puts that. So he could say he's talking about the economy, but it's also put in a way,
right,
as I interpret it, to conjure up images of undeserving so-called welfare queens from the Reagan era. And I want to play a contrasting clip because Mitt Romney offered the same policy critique, but with very different language about food stamps in this brief reference in Monday night's debate.
I'm going to make sure that we get people off of food stamps, not by cutting the program, but by getting them good jobs.
So, Tricia Rose, how would you compare and contrast Romney and Gingrich? And are they each representative of something? Because he was very careful, as he's tacking back toward the center especially, to try to not demonize people who are on food stamps or the fact that the food stamp rolls have increased as, you know, a giving to the undeserving, just saying, I want to improve the economy so fewer people need them.
Right, right. Well, of course, both Gingrich and Romney are acting as if Obama prefers to give out, right, food stamps over jobs. That's the critical matter.
Well, I'm not sure I heard that in the Romney language, which is why I'm bringing up the
there's been a year of constant drumbeat of this ideology in billboards, in TV ads, in the whole primary race. I mean, Romney basically now can, as many people called it, dog whistle the concept. One needn't be aggressive at this point. In fact, it could, as you know, be a bit of a backlash against him if he does. So, no, he didn't say that way, but the formulation has already been constructed. So he doesn't have to say that. I mean, Obama, too. Who wants people on food stamps? So How is that distinguishing him from Obama? You see my point? He can only distinguish himself from Obama there if the assumption is that Obama doesn't want the same thing. And that's part of, you know, this is, Lee Atwater talked about this very explicitly, about this thing that, called the Southern Strategy.
The late Republican strategist.
Yes, the late Republican strategist. Thank you, Brian. What he articulated was this notion of how to foment, how to cultivate anxiety, frustration, rage, and racial ideology among whites. It's a way of creating an identity. It's not that whites or anyone has a racial identity that means anything. It's we create it, right? And what he said very clearly was moving from explicit racial hatred language to abstraction. So you associate things that are helpful when black people use them with black people's dependence and greed and laziness and criminality. And in so doing, You keep an attitude of racial hostility going, but you also reduce these programs for everyone. So it's a set of policies that there's no question the Republican primaries and this Republican Party's platform is mimicking entirely.
We have 30 seconds left. Obviously, the dialogues will continue here and hopefully elsewhere between people among many races and white perspectives and black perspectives and various Latino and Asian and everybody's perspectives. But we've just gone through four presidential campaign debates, and I haven't done an actual document search, but Tricia, in our last 20 seconds, I don't remember the word race ever coming up. Did I miss something?
No, I don't think you did. We both missed something because it didn't happen. And I think, you know, again, the idea that transcending racism means not talking about racism when it's happening is, you know, an Alice in Wonderland moment that we haven't yet caught up with addressing. And I think that's where our heart has to be, working together to really address realities, not just transcend old wounds, but stop creating new ones.
Tricia Rose, professor of Africana Studies at Brown University and author of the book The Hip Hop Wars. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us. Jad Abumrad from Radio Lab coming up next.